Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, thanks for tuning in to Inner Spark Radio, a weekly show in which I talk with experts about ways to ignite the spark within. I'm your host, Lena Gazurian, and you can learn more about upcoming shows as well as listen to archive shows at innersparkradio.com, on Facebook, on Blog Talk Radio, and also on iTunes. And I'm really delighted and honored to have Freddie Silva as today's guest. So for those of you who aren't so familiar with Freddie, let me just tell you a little bit about him. Freddie is one of the world's leading researchers on sacred sites, ancient systems of knowledge, and the interaction between temples and consciousness. He's the best-selling author of The Templar Nation and The Divine Blueprint. His first book, Secrets in the Field, The Science of Mysticism and Crop Circles, is a critically acclaimed work published in four languages, providing the only thorough appraisal of this much misunderstood phenomenon. And his fourth book, The Lost Art of Resurrection, has just been released this month, so I'd like to ask him about that today as well. He's also directed several documentaries, has lectured worldwide for over a decade with many keynote appearances, in addition to appearances on the Discovery Channel, BBC, and radio shows such as Coast to Coast. He is described by the CEO of the Universal Light Expo as, quote, perhaps the best metaphysical speaker in the world right now. Not too shabby of a title. He leads sacred site tours in Britain, France, Malta, Peru, and Egypt. And he also has beautiful photographs on his website. And so you can learn more about Freddie and his work at invisibletemple.com. So welcome, Freddie.
Hello, Lena.
Hello. So I just also want to say one thing about your book, The Divine Blueprint, which is, you know, what this is based on today. And I just have to say it's really an amazing compilation of research. It's engaging, it's informational, it's sometimes humorous. It's very accessible. And the word holographic actually is sort of coming to my mind when I would think about how it sort of lands in me. It's if that makes any sense to you, but it's...
Well, it makes total sense.
Yeah. So it's really... Yeah, just want to... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think there's a sort of two-second time lapse between New York and Portland, Maine. No, actually, it's a very good observation because, I mean, these the sacred sites and the temples, I mean, they're much more than just physical components that most people just go to these places. Yeah, and they look at the rocks, the stones, and the columns and things, and they appreciate the physicality of these places. But there's so much more than that. They're layers upon layers upon layers. And the more you engage with them, the more the layers seem to come at you, which you know, makes them very multidimensional in many ways. So you can appreciate them visually, or you can appreciate them from an energetic point of view. And thanks to science today, we now know that these places are very much alive and breathing. So depending on your point of view, you can go there and experience different parts of these holograms and take away whatever it is that you went there for. So it's always, you know, useful to sort of approach these ancient sites with a certain sense of veneration and open-mindedness and without an agenda, because you just don't know what you're going to get when you get there. And that's part of the fun. It's like going on a sort of a topographic journey into the ether, and when you come back, you're never quite the same person.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask this maybe later, but since you brought that up, maybe it's a good time now to say, to ask you. So, for those of us who are going to go to any kind of a sacred site, what is the best way to approach it in terms of, how would you say would be the best way to approach the experience?
Oh, the best way is to come with me. Come on my tours. No, seriously, it's. I think it's the way I've learned it, and I mean, I first read everything about these places that wasn't nailed to the floor, like we all do. We get very passionate about these things, and then after a while, you begin to realize that the books aren't enough. There has to be an experiential side of things. And that's how I approach my writing. It's a little bit of historical background, but I also talk about it from a first-person experience. And what I found was that the less baggage you take in with you, the more you get out of these places. You certainly go there with a certain intent, There's something that you're looking for. And it's as though the place has already figured out what you want before you even get there. And you find that these coincidences start popping out of the woodwork. People that were not supposed to be there will be there. And they'll take you inside certain rooms that shouldn't be, within the public domain. And then magic starts to happen. And then some people just want to go there to communicate with another level of reality. That will be their intent, and somehow things manifest that would allow for that experience. So setting the intent is a very important thing before you go to traveling to these places, because it sets the agenda on which the temple will respond to you in a certain way. Having said that, each time that you go back to the same place, you'll find that you'll be getting a different level of information back. It's as though the two of you get to have this sort of relationship, this very intimate relationship, and slowly, as just like the people, when we break through the first barrier, you start going a bit more under the surface, and you start discovering all kinds of interesting things. So that's how I would do it. But the second most important thing, if you can possibly bear it, and I know this is very hard for all you earth signs who are listening, try to fast before you go. Take as little as your body as you possibly can in there. And I usually find this in Egypt, for example, where incredibly, it's actually very easy to get around without eating very much. Just take a few dried fruit with you and some water, because you need that to keep you going. But the more, the less of your body, your physical body that you take in, the more you get into this sort of surreal state of mind where you're not really bogged down by your physical state, which is the one thing that we try to escape whenever we go to these sacred sites. And that's the reason why they were built. They want you to get out of your physical body and go somewhere else. So if you can just do those two things, you're already putting yourself in a place of receptivity, which is the start, the journey into what the ancestors used to call the other world, which is primarily what the sacred sites really are doing. They're trying to get you to cross into another barrier, into another reality.
Okay, thank you. And then on that introduction, we can just go right into, maybe you could just get a little bit more into what you think or what you've discovered is the true purpose of, just go a little bit more into that, of building these sacred sites.
Well, here's the funny thing. Once you start peeling through the layers of recent history, you begin to realize that, as we already know, the victors always rewrite history in their own words. And things in the last 2,000 years have become very, very squiffy. It's a very technical term.
Yes, it is.
And it's very hard to trust the last 2,000 years of organized religion and how they portrayed ancient sacred sites. So you have to go back to the deeper layers of history and find out what was going on. And it became very obvious that these places were built as sort of self-help centers. First of all, they were built in order to mark certain places on the landscape. And you can talk to any Native American today or any Native culture around the world, and they will still tell you that these places were built on top of the navels of the earth, because at some point the people that came before us, they knew that we'd become so enamored with our cell phones and our physical world that we'd forget about what was actually important in life, which is the connection to nature. And it may sound very silly and superficial, but that is the most important thing why we've come here on the face of the earth, which is to engage with the world around us, not be stuck with the cell phone all the time and totally be oblivious to what's going around us. So somehow they seem to have sort of figured this out, and they realized that we would lose the plot sometime in our history, and they marked these hot spots of energy with large standing stones or big pyramids or temples, and eventually Gothic cathedrals as well. And, modern science has now come to the understanding that, indeed, at these spots, known laws of physics are slightly different. There are gravitational anomalies. There are electromagnetic anomalies. And what we now know about the body and the mind and how it works exactly on the same principles, that if you engage in an environment where the rules are slightly distorted and the local electromagnetic field is slightly distorted, you start making your body succumb to the forces that surround you, and that's when you start engaging with your environment and your brain starts to synthesize what's around it. And so this is an incredible feat of engineering that the ancestors built these temples to create these effects where it looks as though you're having a kind of shamanic experience or an out-of-body experience. And it's exactly what is happening. If you go well prepared and you prepare to accept that these things will happen, then you engage with these temples and the temples start working their magic on you. So as I was saying before, if you take your intent to these places and you're looking for something specific, it's as though you're sending little packets of energy into the site and the temple starts reacting in kind and it starts sending you images or feelings or what we also call in technical terms the tingly winglies. We start feeling a certain shiver up the spine and before you know it, you're seeing things out of your peripheral vision. You start getting visions, heightened states of consciousness. Some people even leave the body and are able to come back, hopefully. And that's one of the reasons why these places were built. It's literally to get you to get out of your body and connect with another level of reality to receive information. And that information is very personal. It's there for all kinds of reasons and to answer all kinds of problems and requests. So primarily that was the main reason why these places were put together, was to try and elicit this communication between a much finer level of reality and the physical world, which you know so often just grounds us down into believing that there's life is bookended by birth and death and a lot of strife in between. But it doesn't have to be that way. You also don't have to sort of take unusual drugs to sort of get out of the body with no control. The advantage of the temple is that you can do this in control, so you can come back still quite sane and actually knowing what it was that you received when you came back.
Mm-hmm. Right, and thank you. And then we'll talk a little bit. I'll have you talk a little bit more about the principles and things. But I did want to ask you a question first, a personal question. Do you remember your first visit or very early visit to a sacred site, and if you felt any impact the first time and where it was?
Oh, that's a very good question, actually. I don't actually remember. I was born in Portugal in an area which is very renowned for some of the older sacred sites in Europe. And I was always very attached to the land when I was very young. I never really wanted to be at home. I wanted to be out in the woods playing with large upright stones, which are now, of course, the dolmens. And I was totally oblivious until I grew up and got to learn about this stuff. And now looking back on it, now that you've made me think about going down amnesia lane, I can say that those are the happiest moments of my life when I literally was away with the fairies. And so many people, even grown-ups, do talk about these situations where they go into these places, such as, say, Stonehenge, to quote something that everyone knows. They do feel subtly different to the world outside these temples. There's something that sometimes they can't explain. And indeed, I do remember most of my dreaming when I was younger, which was associated with those hotspots. And then later when I moved to London, which is where I get this ridiculous accent from, I do remember
one
time...
That's a wonderful accent.
It's sort of transatlantic now. I do remember when I was married, suddenly getting the urge to go to Stonehenge one Friday afternoon. And anyone who's lived in London knows you do not get in your car on a Friday afternoon and leave town because it takes you hours to get out of the city, especially in the summer. But I felt compelled, and I don't know why, and I eventually got to Stonehenge for the first time in my life. And there was thousands of people there, and the police were moving people around, the traffic around. And I said, well, what's going on? Is it some kind of circus? And said, no, it's something called a harmonic convergence. Mm-hmm. And so I went. I was totally oblivious to this, and I only realized later the importance of this event that changed so many people's lives. It was one of those magical dates on the astrological calendar which turned the key in everybody's consciousness, if you're open to that. And I can pretty much sense my moment of change from the physical modern world of commerce and start getting more involved in what I do now at that moment. So it's funny how these things do work. And it's a wonderful example now that you've reminded me of just how these places do wake people up to their biggest potential, and then they ask them, well, which road do you want to take now? And having given up my very wealthy life in advertising to do this, which is not very wealthy, I can say, hand on heart, that it's actually been a wonderful privilege, and I certainly wouldn't say no to doing it all over again, because it's been so much fun, because it has helped helped me figure out my life purpose here. But it's also through my understanding and through my books and my work that I teach others to open up to the bigger picture, and I've also seen changes in them. And ultimately, yes, that's what the temples are doing. They're getting you to open up to your biggest potential, and that can't be a bad thing.
No, not at all. And you've been to many sites around the world, and some places many times. I guess I'm just curious if you've noticed recently, I mean, you say that these are dynamic places, and so we bring energy to them, right? And perhaps good, and perhaps sometimes not so good. And so maybe they are, they're occasionally, so they do change. But have you noticed, is there a place you've been to where you've noticed in particular that it's shifted in such a way that you really feel there's something growing there, or something percolating? Like, is there a spot?
Oh, I think it's been brewing for quite some time. And in fact, if we go back to your original question, now that we know so much about the human body and the power of intent, which has been proven yet again and again to be little packets of electromagnetic signals that we send out into the world, it's a very important thing. So if you think about the effect that you have when you go to these places and your intent and your feelings are carrying these electromagnetic signals, and these temples are so hardwired into the natural ecosystem of the Earth. I mean, these places are built exactly on the same laws as the planet and the universe around you. That's why they look and feel good. They are perfect. It would follow then that if you'd go in with a certain negativity into these places, the temple will remember that. And that, considering that the main element in all temples around the world, without exception, is the element of water. They all sit on bodies of water. And now that we know that water can carry a memory, the effect of a positive or a negative feeling accumulated over time, multiplied by tens of thousands of feet, is enough to show that, yes, you can have a beneficial or a detrimental effect when you go to these sites. So, for example, one of the most common things I get asked is, should I go to Glastonbury this year? And I said, well, it really depends on who's been there and who's been doing what. I can go there every other year. In fact, I'm about to go there in a few weeks on tour. And every other year I go there, I just don't want to be there, because people have done some very silly things. And they feel like they've got to do devil worship and bring out witches and all kinds of stuff, which they have no idea what they're doing. And they work with the dark arts, and it stays there. And it takes groups like myself to go there, clean it up. And people go back next year and they say that, wow, it feels so much different this year. Mm. And the pyramids feel so much different this year. And it is. It's a constant struggle between light and dark, just like in real life. Some people, go there and they leave their deposit goodwill. And I can say, hand on heart, that whenever I go to some of the less frequented places, that they are actually buzzing quite nicely. It's as if something has woken things up around the world, and these places are back into a living state. And you can tell just by the amount of people that go to these sites nowadays as plain tourists, that something is drawing them there. And it's not just because of the internet that makes these places more available to people. There is a sudden need for people on a subconscious level to travel to these places. And I'm seeing that growing again and again each year, exponentially so. And more often than not, I find that these places are very beneficial, because I've never seen people have a fight or get angry in temples. People might disagree about religion, and they might have fights outside churches about religion, but you never see that happening inside cathedrals or any other place. So there's something very, very grounding about these places that get you connect with something much bigger than yourself. So if you study that and multiply it millions of times around the world with all the sites that exist, then obviously some kind of awakening is taking place. And it's so subtle that the media will never pick this up. But watching this on a conscious level every day as I do, I can say yes, I think many more people are now much more aware of what these places do, some of them grudgingly so, because of the way that they've been brought up, and usually it's, you know, religion that has the problem with that. But they're slowly realizing that the system that they've been taught doesn't work, and they're gravitating these places, and these places are having their magic on them. So slowly, as they say, we catch the monkey.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's right. It's feeding. It's kind of feeding upon, and we are feeding it, and they are feeding us, and it's like this. It's really a dynamic relationship that you're particularly noticing even more and more right now.
It's like a big loop, essentially. In fact, if you take that thought further, and if you look at the process of homeopathy, which, despite what you might read here and there, it has been validated in five different laboratories in Europe. And these results were done by people who were not paid to say that homeopathy doesn't work. So you can read in between that what you will. So we've known this for thousands of years. The Egyptians talked about homeopathy and the power of water to remember back in 8000 BC. So clearly something works. Now, if you and I go to these, let's say, to a holy well or a sacred spring, and you go there and you leave your prayers behind, the next person, essentially, will be drinking the water containing the positive affirmations of the people before them, and they leave something of them behind. So you've got this constant feedback loop going back again and again. And this is why I call these places self-help centers, because they're free. You go there, you leave a few of your problems, but you also leave some positive affirmations, and you drink those positive affirmations from the water that remembers what's been going on there for thousands of years. So it's a very romantic way of doing it, but it's also provable. Because the water from these places, when you look at it under the microscope and you compare it to normal tap water, it shows that it's actually alive. There are millions of little vortices moving around in a very excited state in this water from sacred sites when you view it under a microscope. And compared to the water that comes out of your faucet, there's hardly anything happening. It's completely dead. So obviously there is something very beneficial to going to these places.
Yeah, it's really a confirmation, isn't it, of the blessings in action, in motion.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. I think it would be great for those who are listening who don't know, if they haven't yet read your book too, to kind of start at the beginning as you know it. It's so interesting, and as I was reading this, I was thinking, now, how come we don't all know this? You know, why isn't this sort of widely taught and known? I was kind of astounded. But if you could tell us more about the occasion of the first time and the flood myths and all that.
Ooh, that's a nice short topic.
We've forgotten all about
this because we have a certain cultural amnesia. As I said, the winners rewrite history in their own view, and the main perpetrators of this is, of course, the Catholic Church, which has nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus in any shape or form. In fact, the new book that just came out on the Lost Art of Resurrection really touches on that, about what the resurrection really is about. It has nothing to do with a guy who gets nailed to a cross and gets up 3 days later. The idea is so ridiculous. It defies all the notion of the laws of nature. And when you look at what Jesus was trying to portray, it's actually very, very different and actually very positive. But I'll leave that there for a second. So in the meantime, we have a system that's trying to basically subjugate the spiritual control of people's souls to go in a certain direction. And it's not a good direction, as we can see. And it has been proved throughout history. In fact, more people have died because of organized religion than through plagues, I think. So something obviously is not right. But if we look back at the ancient myths, which always recorded a certain aspect of the truth in their own language, and this is why myth is always so hard to decode, because it's written in a language that's now, and in visions and in images that, compared to what we know today, seem ridiculous and fantastical. But 2,000 years from now, the people that will come along will say that people staring into a little glass screen 4 inches by two was equally preposterous, you know.
they probably will
be intuiting everything by then. But if you look back at the myths, it's quite clear that something happened, something very dramatic happened here on the face of the earth. And if you compare the myths of the Tamil culture of southern India, which is one of the oldest cultures on earth, and compare it to what the Egyptians were writing about back in 12,000 BC, it shows that something very large hit the earth. In fact, recent geological records show that a meteorite actually broke up into 7 pieces and hit the earth exactly in the right spots to create tidal waves of a nature that you would not even believe. And I was reading one of the geological reports that showed that these waves carried whales all the way from the coast of New York all the way up to Vermont and deposited these enormous animals on top of mountaintops, along with the bones of mammoths and the bones of human beings. So clearly, the whales weren't on the top of the mountain because of some continental shifts in the ground. It was because they were dumped there by a lot of water. So all of these stories, there's something like 180 flood myths around the world by people who supposedly had no contact with each other, which all talk about the same thing. And then basically they said that there was a time of a golden age. There were these cities of knowledge that were presided by very tall beings, also presided by people who had enormous mental capacity. And they built these enormous cities in places which are now underwater, which is why it's so hard to find them, although traces of them have been found so far. Mm. And the survivors were told to basically start from scratch. And if you look at the Egyptian myths, it clearly tells that there was a group of people called the followers of Horus, whose charge it was to rebuild the former mansions of the gods at specially marked locations, which would then form the foundations of the future historical temples. And you think, what on earth are these people smoking? Well, when you start looking at the archaeology and the geology to back this up, it's quite clear that the temples throughout the ancient world in Egypt and in India all sit on deep layers of very, very old material. So, for example, if we go south of the pyramids to the Osirian at Abydos, there is this wonderful temple that's below the ground where resurrection ceremonies to Osiris used to take place. Except if you look at the geological reports, it shows that these things weren't underground. They were buried by at least 8,000 years of the Nile flooding and reflooding. So we're talking about a time which coincides with this period at about 9,000 BC when the temples began to be rebuilt on these special locations. And you go to India, it's the same story. You go to Europe, it's the same story. So clearly, the clock was reset again. And when I was reading these hieroglyphs which mark this story in the Temple of Edfu in Egypt, it talked about how these sites were supposed to be used to reawaken people to their biggest potential. And, of course, now we've come full circle and realized that, yes, exactly, that is exactly what the temples are built for. And they were built with big stones to survive the chaos of times, to be made available today to people who had lost the plot. So it goes back to what I was saying earlier about people going to the temples nowadays en masse as though they're picking something up. Something's woken in the landscape and they're being drawn to this. So the myth is being validated by the very actions that we're doing today. We're going back to these places that were originally set there as an insurance policy for the times when humanity would lose the plot and they would stop honoring the gods, which to them were nothing more than the forces of nature. They're not necessarily a human physical people. They were just the forces that bind nature together. So all of this is written in the record of the time of the first occasion. And the same story exists in the Andean stories of the flood and also in southern India and China and Japan. So clearly something was reset and this time of the first occasion, which can now be dated to about 10,500 BC, was then brought under the waves yet again and restarted yet again in 9,300 due to the geological records. So we keep getting hit again and again with these strange catastrophes, but you know, we go on surviving. People do survive, and they rebuild these places so we can maintain that connection to the divine.
Yes, it was interesting you said 7 pieces of stone, and I was struck by that because of the 7 sages, and I don't know, 7 just seems to be kind of an interesting number. But
yeah, it's funny that.
Yeah.
I'm about to go to Tiwanaku in Bolivia in a couple of months, and the same symbolism is in the temples, in the number of steps, the number of rooms, the number of side chambers. It's always based on seven. And of course, it's always to do with the ancients always used to define everything by number and geometry as a distillation of how the universe works. I mean, the idea was that you build places that are a complete mirror image of nature, and the closer you get to that mirror image, the more you feel at home in these human-made temples, because you are at home. You are completely in an environment that mirrors the world in its perfection. And of course, at its very basic, seven is to do with the seven notes of the pure music scale, and also the seven colors in which we see light. So these are very formative, causative forces of nature, which lie at the heart of how everything is created in the universe. And ironically, the only thing that every religion in the world agrees on. If you look at all the stories of all their, you know, of their sacred books, such as the Bible and the Quran, and the Hindu Vedas, they all agree that at the very beginning there was the Word, and the Word, of course, was with God, or a creative principle. And, of course, that Word is sound, and sound breaks down into seven very nice vowels, which, incredibly, I discovered this by... It was a piece of research by the violinist Yehudi Menuhin, who was perplexed that whenever he traveled around the world, he noticed that when children, before they actually learn to form words, they always sing in the note of Do-Re-Mi. And it was always believed that the Do-Re-Mi was a Western scale, which indeed it is. I mean, it's at some point it is. The Do-Re-Mi doesn't exactly exist in the Indian music scale. It's Indian music has half tones. But it's interesting that before you form words, you sing in the tones of the Do-Re-Mi, no matter where you are in the world. And it's only after the cultural imprint starts making its effect known to you and you start developing language, then you start appreciating your local music. So it seems that these seven notes that make up the octave appear to be hardwired in our system. So, and then, of course, they are mirrored in the design of temples. It's very clever, and it makes you wonder how these people actually figured it out in the first place.
It is. It is really. It's very interesting. And I have to say, I mean, there is so much you write about in the book that we obviously can't go into today in terms of all the facets, like astronomy, astrology, and cycles, and numbers, and sacred geometry, and all that. But maybe we can talk about... I guess just along those lines, maybe one of the interesting things I found was how you talk about how some of these places are designated for to be as masculine or feminine in terms of providing that energy or maybe balanced energy, and how they go about doing that, as in, you know, the different stones and formations. So could you just explain a little bit about why they would be structured that way and how it actually affects us, what goes into that? An example of a place, perhaps.
It was very interesting, just based on observation, that, for example, in the Celtic Christian era, there were so many churches that, for no reason, were either dedicated to a masculine entity and one to a feminine. And I sort of made these mental notes, and I'd go to sacred sites, and ones would feel much more pushy than others, and I made a note of that. It was when I began to look into the concept of energy and energy lines that basically flow across the face of the earth, and they're always depicted in the form of serpents, which ironically NASA actually validated about 6 years ago. They actually said that they'd actually talked about these lines of force that move across the face of the earth. Now, why NASA picked that up is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So thousands have known this for thousands of years as well. And I began to watch people when they went to the same, for example, when they go to the same pyramid of Giza. There are three pyramids you can choose, and everybody wants to go to the big one. And they go in, and I look at some people, and they don't feel comfortable, but some do. And I'm wondering, well, there should be no reason. I mean, there's no real decoration here. There's nothing to really distract your vision or make you feel uncomfortable unless you're claustrophobic. But then I watch the same people go to the pyramid next door, and I'd find that the ones that were feeling uncomfortable in the Great Pyramid would be fine in the second pyramid. I'm wondering, well, now that is a bit odd. Why should there be a difference? And of course, you start looking at the energy that, preface this by saying that all sacred sites on the face of the Earth, without exception, they all mark the intersecting lines of the Earth's electromagnetic pathways of energy. Some, just like an electrical outlet, are masculine or positively charged, and some are negatively charged. Sometimes they carry both. And that's where the big aha went, which was that because we are all individually hardwired, some people just like going towards that sort of masculine energy, and some people just prefer that softer, more receptive feminine energy. And this is what sort of draws people to certain sites and not the others. The body kind of tells you what it needs and what it wants for its optimum health and its optimum connection with the land. So you tend to find that wherever you travel, you tend to sort of find the energy that seems to be most beneficial to you and also most missing in your body, because the body's trying to soak up some of this energy so it can rebalance it and recalibrate its own system. All of this made a lot of sense once you start observing this for about 15 years and writing it all down. And the other thing is that I also found that there are some places which seem to be eternally receptive to all kinds of people. And those are the ones where the positive and negative charges are found in the same building or the same location. It seems to be the prime reason why so many people want to find balance at these places. And I often find, and I know some people in the Western world will find this hard to believe, but I often find that a lot of those are actually Islamic mosques, the ones that were sort of used. Yeah, because if you look at the geometry of the mosques, they're all octagonal, and the octagon was always the symbol of the balance of opposites. So it's masculine and feminine. Masculine will carry, you know, number four, feminine four. You overlap the two, you get eight. It's also the physical and the non-physical. So it's the meeting of opposites. And the Templars knew about this because they picked up on this information when they were in the Holy Land, and they brought this back to Europe. And that's when we started getting a lot of geometry related to the number eight found throughout Europe, and also especially in the Gothic cathedrals that they built. So they knew about this also in India and also in the Far East. So these things are really are not defined by modern religion. They override modern religion because they're based on the natural laws of the planet. So this is the reason why some places have this energy, this positive charge, and some have this negative charge, and you are drawn to the one that you sort of need the most.
Yes, and in your in the DVD, and I'm forgetting the actual name of it in this moment. Not temple making, no, the other one, where you give the lecture.
Location
and you've
got of paradise?
Yes, location of paradise, thank you. It's really amazing. For those who haven't seen it, I definitely recommend that as well, because how you show over and over these intersecting the lines of energy and where all these sacred sites fall, and it's amazing. I mean, there's absolutely no way it's a coincidence, right?
It's beyond coincidence. Originally, when the people, when our ancestors didn't build temples, they could just go there because they could see this stuff. They'll just sit there and go, okay, I'm going to sit there for a day, meditate, I'm going to feel fine. And animals do exactly the same thing. They source the same hotspots of energy to either give birth or get better. In fact, I found an old tradition in the early Celtic church that said that the priests, who were often dowsers as well, which is incredible, they would first locate the sites where animals used to go to get better, and then they would found the church on that spot. So you see the correlation by observing nature and the beneficial sites of nature. You then build a building that would also be beneficial to people.
Very astute, those priests were, huh?
So not bad.
Not bad, yeah. Well, you give some examples of your own experiences in the book at some of these sites, which is great because, again, it shows the dynamic of sort of what can happen in the interplay. So it would be great if you would share whichever one you'd like to share today as an experience that you've had and that what can happen in these places.
Oh, my God. Yes, quite a few of those.
I know.
It depends where you are in life. I mean, people ask me, well, what's your favorite one? And I said, I really don't know. I have lots. And, it depends where I am today. might be feeling a certain sympathy with a certain site, and tomorrow it'll be something else, because we're all different and we're all needing different things, and each site has its own particular characteristic which will enhance that effect. I was just up in Callanish, up in the Isle of Lewis, which is this huge island off the coast of Scotland, godforsaken place with 70-mile-an-hour winds. And it's a place I've always wanted to get to my entire life, and I'm glad that I was forced to wait until now, until I think I know what I'm doing, to appreciate the power and the energy of a place that has been so unadulterated by human thought and by the problems of the last 2,000 years, because it was mostly buried in peat halfway up its stones, so it hasn't been polluted. And if anybody wants to go and get a real hit of what it's like to feel in the energy of a site that's totally pristine and unpolluted and clear as the day it was built, then Callanish is your place. And I will tell you that you will hear the stones speak, and they will move. They will feel like they're actual beings. And it's not even an exaggeration. And I can't wait to go back there. I've been in places. There's a stone circle, again in Scotland, in Loch Buie, which people would travel to, and you have to cross a marsh, and they'll swear at me, that, you know, why the hell are we here? You know, there could have been something nicer and closer. And then you get there, there's these little sort of nine stones, and it's very underwhelming, and they'll feel that, well, whatever, they travel halfway around the world to see these nine rocks. And the moment they walk in, and I'll say nothing, and the moment they walk in, they start crying. I mean, it's a place that, of all the sites that I've been to, that there's, you cannot feel the layers in between you and the other levels of reality. I mean, you are so naked in your body, and you feel as if you're in this tunnel, and you are totally connected to everything that exists. And it's hard to explain in words what that feels like, but and I'm a very grounded person, by all means. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you, it's an experience where you feel so connected with the core of creation that it's hard to put into words. That was a highlight of my life. But another highlight was something that was eventually validated by the people, and also by people that had the same experience about 100 years ago. And I had not known this when it happened, and I also wasn't asking for it to happen. But one of my most profound life-changing experiences, when I went into the Great Pyramid, watched everybody move out of the building, which is really rare. And it's just three guys and myself were left alone in total darkness. Someone switched off the lights, and we're in the King's Chamber. And in complete darkness, I saw what must have looked like over 30 very tall people dressed in white garments, literally coming out of the rocks and surrounding us. And this is in total darkness. And I never felt so loved in my entire life. I mean, there was nothing to be afraid of. And I was doing a little bit of toning as well. We're doing a little ceremony to honor the site and cleanse it as well. So I'm trying to remember this as I'm doing this stuff, and hoping I'm going to remember this when I've come out of this trance. The whole thing was so awake. I don't think I was dreaming it. And about 20 minutes later, the lights went back on. We took turns going into the sarcophagus and traveled to some very interesting places in 5 minutes. Came back out completely dazzled, and these four grown men looking at each other in the daylight of the of Cairo, and clearly we wanted to say something to each other. And as usual, guys try to sort of, you know, be very brave about this stuff. And so I said to one of them, I said, "Did you see what I saw up there?" And he said, "You mean the people that came out of the stones dressed in white, and they're really tall? There's about 30 of them." I said, "Yes." And all of us had exactly the same experience, and you can't make that up, because, first of all, we weren't doing drugs, we weren't doing ayahuasca, we weren't also going there with the intention of seeing or experiencing that, so it's not psychosomatic. So for four individual people in total darkness to see the same people, and to have this validated by other people who I've communicated since, who also let the cat out of the bag that, yes, they also had seen it, but being hard-nosed scientists, they can't talk about it. And I even read a book by one of my favorite writers called Paul Brunton, the only book I hadn't read when I was writing this book. And I thought, has he also had the same experience when he was in Egypt back in the 1920s? And would you believe it? He also had the same experience, and he described these people exactly in the same way that I've just described. So this is part of the magic of what happens when you walk into these places with the same PIN number as these sites. Something really wakes up, and if you're lucky, you will also have these experiences, and your life wakes up before you, and then you're given the proposition of, well, do you want to carry on life as usual, or do you really want to do what you came here to do? you really have a soul awakening moment. It can be very difficult. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody should do this by any length of the imagination. I mean, you're always struggling for a paycheck every month.
Right.
So, you know, and the divorce rate is something like 99%. It is challenging, but the fringe benefits are extraordinary because you suddenly realize you are indulging in something that is beyond time and space. It's something that's been performed by people who gave up part of their free will to undertake this courageous journey to show others that you don't have to live life in fear. You can have a degree of self-control over your process of manifestation, and that's essentially what I've started to teach, because literally just through example and through experience, that there is a defined degree of control you can have over how you comport yourself here on Earth. And when you know that, life becomes much easier to navigate. And that's essentially what this whole process of sacred space is about. It's about knowing who you are, where you've come from, what you've come here to do, and engaging in that process, no matter how easy or how hard it is, and doing it and living it. And at the end, when you die, which, as Robin Williams said recently, it's death is nature's way of saying your table is ready. You can say, wonderful guy, you can say, no one else told me how to live my life. I'm not going to blame anybody else for my failings and my successes. I can take complete control and responsibility for what's happened to me. And you can say you've led an exemplary life and you've done it exactly the way it should have been. And if for nothing else, that is the prime reason why you should engage with sacred space and the prime reason why you should travel to these places.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, thank you. It's such a compelling story, and it's there are more stories like that. And it's true, yes. And it's a great illustration of how you're saying how dynamic these places are. And I think, for those of us who've maybe been to some or maybe haven't been yet, maybe we think of it more as, let me go and see what this place is like, rather than thinking, well, let me go experience, let me go interact. And, I mean, that story just really illustrates what's possible,
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, that's great.
These people breathe, and these temples breathe. They're like meeting long-lost relatives. And, some of them you get along with, some you don't, because, I mean, we're all different notes of music, and these places are built to certain geometry, certain ratios, and they too have their own song to sing. So when the two of you engage, obviously it's a big party.
Yes.
Or if you don't feel that it's a party, then move on to the next place, because it's obviously not your energy. So, there are people that go to Stonehenge and they go, ho-hum, I don't feel good here. And they'll walk, about 12 miles north to Avebury, and they'll have a completely different experience. Because Stonehenge is a very masculine temple, and Avebury is a very feminine temple. It's not about right or wrong. It's about what's appropriate. So think about it in that term as well, that some places are meant for you and some places just aren't. So see what works and what doesn't.
Right. And you did write something as well about slightly cautionary, I guess, too, about maybe there could potentially be too much too soon. Am I remembering this correctly? Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'll preface it by saying that I'm a Tory, and so I'm one of those people that has to touch, feel, suck, chew, and eat everything that's in front of me before I go and talk about it. And it can be annoying because sometimes you do sort of overstep the boundaries of what is realistic. And I have been experienced at places before I really knew what I was totally doing. Too much, and you leave 48 hours later and you still got a headache and you got a bit of a buzz, and then you sort of ground yourself and you're fine. I mean, it's not going to, these places aren't going to kill you or anything. It's just that they are hardwired in a certain way, and it's all electromagnetic, or at least electromagnetically based, and so are you. And you're also two-thirds water, and those two elements are the prime elements that make up any sacred space. So since you're an electrical being and you're going to stick your fingers in this outlet called a temple, if that energy in there happens to be of a certain frequency that you are not, you're going to get fried. And so the reason why I caution people that when you approach these places and you feel like you perhaps shouldn't go in and you get that gut feeling that you shouldn't be there, you should follow that, because it's your someone is trying to tell your gut feeling that this perhaps isn't quite right for you yet. And I remember a time when I was learning this material, and I walked into this very old dolmen in the south of Britain called the Devil's Den. And it's a very powerful place, very raw energy. And unless you really know what you're doing, you shouldn't be there. And I had no idea, and of course. And actually, this is a very funny story. I sort of jumped the gate. There's a sort of the whole area around this dolmen is fenced. It's farmland. And I jumped over the fence. I couldn't be bothered to find out who the farmer was. Because they can live about 10 miles away, you know.
Oh.
And you have to explain why you're going there. And usually they're fine. They just won't be asked permission. But I was a bit lazy that day. And I jumped the fence, and I heard this enormous booming voice in the middle of nowhere saying, you know, go no further. You are not allowed here. And I thought, damn, I've been caught. And the voice sounded like it came from a real physical person. And I looked around, uh-huh. and I couldn't see anyone. I couldn't see the farmer. So I thought, no, I'm just imagining things. And I took two more steps, and this big booming voice definitely came at me to a point where I couldn't actually move. I mean, it's as though I was actually pressed against a piece of glass. And
wow.
I thought, okay, I'm going to go back over the fence and come back some other time. So I went, drove up and saw a friend of mine who happens to be possibly one of the world's greatest psychics. Even the police and the military ask her for information. She is that good. And we were having a little cup of tea, and I hadn't mentioned anything. And she says, "Are you having some trouble at the Devil's Den?" And I said, "How do you know?" I said, "Well, I know everything." And she does.
Clearly.
She really does. And I said, "Well, I heard this booming voice that says I really shouldn't be there. It frightened the hell out of me." And it says, "Well, you know, well, you're still learning this material. I mean, once you realize that everything is down to energy and it's sympathetic resonance, now your resonance just isn't ready to accept what's there. You'll be fried. Your circuits will be absolutely fried, and that's not going to do you any good.
Mm-hmm.
Come back in a few years when you know what you're doing." And it was the best advice I was giving, because 5 years later I went back for the first time, and sure enough, it was like this curtain opening. I felt very welcome. In fact, I was being sucked into the middle of this dolmen, and I feel fine with it now. So it's a good illustration that it's not about right or wrong. It's about what's compatible. You know, once you start feeling compatible with these places, then that's when that interchange takes place, when the information starts exchanging via energy through to you. And then, of course, the magic starts taking over.
Yes, not to override. Clearly somebody was looking out for you.
Oh, totally, and it's always useful to pay attention.
Yes,
it really
to pay
is.
Attention.
I mean, it's there for a reason.
Right. Sometimes we just want it to be what we want it to be, but yeah, that's a good yeah, that's a good cautionary tale. I think, you know, just due to time, I mean, I think you've just given kind of a beautiful overview and illustration of sort of what they're about and sort of how to approach them. And before, I wanted to talk a little bit about your new book, too. So before we jump there, is there anything we didn't talk about that you just want to make sure people know about, or anything you want to emphasize as a takeaway in terms of the sacred sites? Yeah.
Ask me a simple question. Well, I mean, the main thing is that I finally realized that these places are living, they're alive, they don't have a sell-by date. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if people that can't go to sacred sites, or where they don't know where the sacred sites are, and particularly in North America, where the native cultures rarely built anything because they knew and still know where they are. They just can see them, they can feel them. New Mexico, for example, I mean, one of my favorite parts of the world. You can go in certain parts of the landscape and you know exactly where you're standing. You're just getting that sort of tingle up your spine.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, that's where the native cultures go and do their ceremonies. So I realized, well, wouldn't it be great if you could synthesize all this and people could build their own sacred site at home? I mean, these places are human built. They are drawing upon natural laws, so we should be able to do them. One of the things that I discovered when I was looking at and observing temples and experiencing them was that wouldn't it be great if you haven't had a chance to go to one of these places or are unable to for whatever reason, and especially in North America, where so many of the temples, the original temples, have been either destroyed or they were never really built in the first place, because the native cultures just resonated with the environment so much that they didn't build much, kind of like in Australia. They just know where the power is. So it'd be nice to sort of, if there was a way to sort of reconstruct this in the modern era. And I actually found out that there is. Once I finally worked out
how all of these places are held together. And it's and there are sort of seven principles behind the temple building. There is, of course, water. This is the one principle that no temple can do without. We have electromagnetism, which binds the energy together. We have the stone that is specially chosen in temples, and sometimes these rocks are carted from hundreds of miles away. We finally worked out why they did this. It was something to do with the type of quartz in the stone. And there's also a lot of magnetite in the stones, which helps the energy bind itself to the rocks. So things are beginning to sort of come together. After that, it was just basically a matter of reconstructing the temples and figuring out the type of geometries involved. There's also a certain type of unit of measure that was used in all of them. But it was the last element that really had me going around in circles for quite some time until I'd sort of thought about this and meditated on it. And the answer was almost there right in front of me. And it's the person itself, the person who actually constructs a temple, and the intent that people bring to the temple that basically glues the whole thing together. So what I did was I began to teach these workshops around the world, where you can literally learn how to construct a temple in one day, which sounds like quite a tall order. And then I put a DVD around the whole thing called Temple Making for those who can't afford the workshops and haven't got the time and can't be bothered. And I wanted to sort of bring down the temple building process to something that even my own grandmother could understand. And it is. It's very, very simple. As long as you work out all the principles, which of course I've done all for you, and then distill them down in the way that it becomes very practical. So right now I'm talking to you from Portland, Maine in my apartment. And there are two temples hardwired into this apartment. One's on my deck. And you wouldn't even know that they're there because it's so well hidden, except for the deck where I do have some substantial rocks. But in my living room, I do have a temple built in there, and you would not know it. But people do know that there's something unusual about the room, and they always go and sit in the one place where all the energy lines literally meet, and they don't know it, but they can feel it. So it's very practical magic, as I call it. It's something that you can use, and the only difference between a temple that you build yourself in a garden or on a land, and people have built these, for example, across Nova Scotia to a diameter of about 45 miles, which is quite complex, and it can be done. The only difference is that, of course, the old ones have thousands of years of advantage, where yours is just now getting going. But yours will have the advantage in the fact that it'll be clean and it'll be brand new energy. And the more you use it, just like watering a flower, the better it gets and more potent it becomes. And then, as I always tell everybody, be careful what you ask for when you go into these spaces, because you might get it, because once it starts to manifest and work with your energy, it starts to multiply that intent and that energy many, many times. And suddenly when you get very proficient at this, and it doesn't take that much, you start to see how the manifestation process becomes so simple. So it's very practical information, which shows that these things aren't just old technology. They're constantly living, and it's something that you can apply in any walk of life.
Yes, and right, it's like harnessing the natural laws wherever you are and then enhancing them in all the ways that you said, like with stones and placement and orientation and things like, and intent and attention. And I have seen temple making, by the way, and if someone hasn't seen it, you do actually show how you do it in your living room. So
it's pretty fun.
They get to see. Yeah, they get to see.
You don't need large rocks, which pleases your landlord.
Yes.
It's very interesting. It's and you get that sort of tingling effect as well. I mean, I've got skeptics that come here for dinner, and that even they can sort of pick up there's something unusual about the place. They like being here, and of course, it was designed for that reason. So it's all very organic and all very natural.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing, bringing that piece in, that more accessible, practical piece that we, you know, I mean, just confirming and affirming that we can do that for ourselves as well as, you know, going out and visiting these places. We can create that. So I think that's very useful. And I did, before we end, I did definitely want to talk about your new book. And it's different, but it's also somewhat related, I think.
Yes.
The Lost Art of Resurrection. So, yeah, what can you tell us about that? What do you want to tell us about it?
Well, here's the funny thing. I mean, when I sort of got into this work, I had no idea that it was I was even going to write a book, let alone four, let alone that they're all linked together in some way. And the undercurrent of all the things that connects these books together, whether I'm writing about crop circles or Templar, Knights Templar or temples, and now resurrection, the undercurrent that pins them all together, I now realize, is this connection with self-empowerment. And it's a thread that runs through every single book. And again, I didn't make this up. It's just something that just happened by the process. And in my last book, when I was writing about the Knights Templar and what they were creating and the fact that they hid the Grail in the country of Portugal, and it's not what you think it is, and it wasn't what I thought it was either, I suddenly got to think about their processes and how they had this brotherhood that worked with this concept of raising the dead, which I thought, it sounds a bit macabre. And I got more into it, and I began to look at the connection to the Egyptian practices, where they also work with something called raising the dead. And this got onto the connection with Catholicism and the resurrection practices which are given to Jesus, and how so many cultures, and especially Islam, has said, and even the Quran does say, that Jesus was actually not resurrected in the way you think he was. I mean, the whole thing has been taken literally. And I found exactly the same quote in the Gospel of Thomas, which was banned by the church, and I thought, now why?